Welcome to the final episode of this season of Sniffing the Pages. I'm Nina Manning.
I'm Katie Griffiths.
And in this episode we discuss Do Not Feed the Bear by Rachel Elliott and The Warehouse by Rob Hart. Katie lets us know what else she's been devouring and what Katie read next. I'm in conversation with Heidi Perks about her writing career and reading pleasures. And finally, we round off discussing some of our favourite reads of this season. So we'll start with Do Not Feed the Bear by Rachel Elliott. It's good, I'm getting really good at remembering authors' names now.
Yeah, it's actually helpful, isn't it? Whereas usually I'm the kind of person who goes, oh, it's by, one, that wrote that other book. Yeah, very helpful. I'll read the blurb. It's, on her 47th birthday, Sydney Smith stands on a rooftop and prepares to jump. Sydney is a cartoonist and freerunner. Feet constantly twitching, always teetering on the edge of life, she's never come to terms with the event that ripped her family apart when she was 10 years old. And so, on a birthday that she doesn't want to celebrate, she returns alone to St Ives to face up to her guilt and grief. It's a trip that turns out to be life-changing, and not only for herself. Do Not Feed the Bear is a book about lives not yet lived, about the kindness of others, and about how, when our worlds stop, we find a way to keep on moving.
So much to say!
Yeah, so I think it's like, this book was just, it's such a surprise to me.
Mm.
It was not at all how I expected from reading the blurb or from reading about it or hearing about it.
I expected to be so much about Sydney and about her life.
Yeah,
I think that's it. But like with everybody's lives, there's so many other intricate... Sorry, the dog is really snory tonight.
Yeah, that's the dog, not me.
There's so many more intricate stories that get woven into and one person's life and that are affected by another person's life.
Yeah,
and the way another person affects somebody else's life. So
it was just, it's a beautiful book. I mean, I ended up taking, you know, marking loads of bits in it and photographing passages to keep because it was so beautiful.
It was quite literary, wasn't it?
It was beautifully written, yeah. And the characters were just really well realised, but just really, I don't know what the word is actually I'm looking for there. I want to say beautifully again, but I'm just trying not to repeat myself.
That's just so beautifully beautiful.
Everything's beautiful about this book. No, but actually also, yes.
I put semi-literary here in my notes.
Yeah, well, sometimes I struggle with like really literary novels and find that quite off-putting. I'm not always a very literary reader, but I didn't have that problem with this at all. It's such a, maybe it's accessible, very accessibly written.
Quite light.
Yeah, and I think just also because the characters are so well done and so engaging and you connect so deeply with them. So it's not just that they're well written or interesting or you kind of identify with them, but I felt really strongly about some of them. I felt like I really knew them. It's a really deep sort of insight into them, and maybe that helps with finding it easy to read and easy to get involved in.
Yeah.
I would have kept going for ages. I didn't want it to end.
No, me too. Yeah, I felt the same. It's one of those books you're rushing to keep going through it, but you know the end is in sight, and it's just that sort of bittersweet, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's just so interesting about, you know, different people's lives and the kind of motivations that they have. So Sydney's obviously had this really traumatic event when she's 10, which it mentions in the blurb, and it's had like huge ongoing repercussions in her life, and also in the lives of the other people in her family, so her dad particularly, and then there are some other
characters. And we're teased
well
with that event, aren't we, for a little while?
Yeah, so
we
it's don't not know clear what exactly what happens. Exactly what it is that happens when she's 10, and it doesn't come out in full until quite a lot later in the book, so it comes out sort of bit by bit as you go through it, doesn't it? But it takes a while. And in some ways that's clever, because I think a part of my mind was imagining it to be like worse than it was. Well, not worse than it was, but maybe more
her fault.
Yeah, so her issue is that, she feels very responsible for what happened, and I think my mind was going all sorts of places as to how that could be the case, or what she could have done, and actually it wasn't quite what I expected, which is good, because it's nice to be surprised.
When she's ready to do some of her jump, I mean, we don't know what she's doing, do we? We don't know what her mindset is, because the book is written in various sections from the perception of Belle and Maria.
Yes, so it's written from different perspectives.
When she falls, we don't know whether that was by accident or...
Well, I think she's been drinking, isn't she? She's a free runner, so she does a lot of, obviously, free running.
Yeah.
And so she's jumping around on the rooftops, which is quite normal for her, but I think she has an accident and it's because she was drinking.
And she wasn't in the right state of mind, was she?
Obviously. Yeah, which is obviously not. I mean, imagine drinking and free running is a big no-no. Super, not very well.
Yeah, but I suppose it's the first time she's been back to the area, hasn't she?
Yeah, so it's her going back to the place where she was on holiday with her parents when this traumatic event happened. And then obviously the other sort of cast of characters are people in the...
It would have been the first time in, what, like 37 years or something, if she's 47?
Yeah, it must be 30 years, the first time she goes back. And she goes back on her own, and she doesn't tell her partner or her dad that she's going. She tells them she's going somewhere else.
Mm.
So there's that sort of element to it as well, and she's doing this very personal sort of pilgrimage, I guess.
Mm. And then we're suddenly thrust into the lives of Belle, Maria and John.
Yeah, so Belle really I absolutely loved.
Yeah.
I just loved her.
She was really quirky. I had images of so many other characters in my head, like the character from Me Before You.
Yeah.
So many of those sort of quirky...
So she works in a bookshop, doesn't she? And she's a bit different.
Like slightly on the spectrum, maybe?
Maybe, yeah. Socially different. I can't remember the... I loved the way it was written about her passages in particular, just her sort of perception of the world.
And she calls herself asexual in the end, doesn't she?
Yeah, so she says that she's asexual and she doesn't have any sort of interest in...
But that's maybe because she hasn't met the right person.
Maybe, there's that sort of implication that it might not necessarily be... It might just be partly because... And also maybe it's like a barrier she's built up around herself, so that she's this kind of... She's quite different, she's been very different from other kids growing up. Doesn't feel that she necessarily is fitted in, so she's built this... Well, this is the impression I've got anyway, she's sort of built this world up around herself. And maybe part of it in her head is viewing herself like that as asexual, so that she doesn't have to explore why she's never been interested in anybody else or why that's never been part of her life, that kind of romantic love.
Yeah. And then there's Dexter, who works with Belle, and then he's obviously very keen, isn't he?
Yeah, I just like them both, actually. And I love them because they're both sort of thinking that the other one is really judging them, and that's that sort of age. They're quite young, aren't they? And it's very, each of them is sort of really unsure of themselves and thinks that the other person doesn't like them, and they're really...
Yeah.
I don't know, if I say this, she's going to think I'm stupid. And that's that perception thing where you don't really realise what's in other people's heads, and you go away from an encounter thinking, I said the wrong thing, or he must have thought this, this and this in me, and they're probably going away from the same encounter thinking exactly the same thoughts. They were all exactly...
Yeah, did we go into Dexter's head at any point? I can't remember. Because she doesn't write in sections. She jumps from one character's perception to another throughout a chapter, doesn't she?
I think there's not much of Dexter, but I think there's a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's his more peripheral, I guess.
Mm. And we should say at this point as well that there's no quotation marks, so there's no speech marks as such. Yeah. So
which takes a little bit of time to get used to when you first start reading it, but actually... I quite like that. Was it normal people? Sally Rooney's like
that,
isn't
it? I think so, yeah.
And
it's quite a literary thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't mind it because I think it helps it flow better in some ways.
I think so, yeah.
But sometimes I do have to pause and think, right, wait, who's saying that?
Mm.
So it does slow me down sometimes a little bit.
So it's interesting the way that Belle, Maria and John, so John is Maria's husband and Belle's dad, are then thrust into the lives of Sydney, Ruth and Howard's lives when they discover Sydney, and then Maria quite maternal, doesn't she, and wants to...
Yeah, so she's the one who finds Sydney after this accident, and then...
And the dog! Sorry, I should say as well, it's from the perspective of the dog as well, at some point.
The dog's the best, actually, I forgot, I haven't even mentioned that. The dog's the best character!
Yeah.
When I first started reading in his perspective, I was like, well, this is weird, and then within a few minutes I was like, oh no, this is brilliant.
That's great, because he can sense all the things...
Yeah, he's like an emotionally sensitive dog, isn't he? Like he can sort of smell emotions effectively. Which I love the idea of. Like, can some dogs do that?
I think they can. It's that psychology, isn't it, of dogs, that they can sense fear and they can sense all those things that perhaps humans can't, or necessarily they sort of switch off from. And
yeah, I love that idea that the dogs just sort of got this insight into people, even when you're sort of walking around pretending, you know, you're putting on a face for the world.
I'll say two things. The other day, I think I'd read something about my book that I didn't want to read. And then I sort of had a funny 5 minutes and I was just sat on the sofa like, oh. It's a bit like in Marley and Me when she loses the baby and then the dog comes and puts his head on her lap. And I think they really sense sadness. And also when I went into labour with my second child, they can smell hormones. well. So they can smell the hormones when they're released from your body. So she was straight over to me and she was nestled into my nook of my arm and was totally, when I was in the sort of early stages of contractions. So yeah, they can. They're very amazing creatures.
Sensitive. Yeah, I just thought it's just the idea that they can see right through any sort of front you're putting on for other people, and the dog's just like, nope, I know how you really feel.
Yeah.
And he's such a fun, funny character from that aspect.
Yeah, it was great. I loved it. So John, he's not a particularly lovable character.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? I did wonder about that, because I thought, with all of these characters, and some of them are quite flawed or different, but there are sort of perspectives given or explanations or understanding that's kind of woven into the narrative that help you understand why they're acting in that way. And with him, he's just a straight up dickhead. Like, there's no redeeming features of him, and there's not really any attempt to help you see anything from his perspective. It's just like, nope, that guy's a dick.
And just pure narcissism to the
extreme. And he's, emotionally abusive and manipulative and
also
not
physically
nice.
Abusive as well.
So
Just pouring some more Pimm's as it's summer.
I found that was interesting that there's sort of no attempt to give him any justification for being like that, which is actually, it's not it's not okay to act in this way. There's no excuses, basically, for his behaviour made.
And it has a brilliant turnaround at the end, doesn't it? And I think with Maria, doesn't it? Her final scene is with them.
I think the last bit is with her,
which is strange, isn't it, from a book's perspective that is based around Sydney's character.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? It makes you wonder, actually, because obviously they had to write quite a short blurb, because you can't write pages and pages for a blurb. And I wonder if you tried to introduce all the other characters in the blurb, it would just be so long.
Yeah.
That's why they didn't bother, or why they chose to focus on Sydney, because I suppose she's the heart of the story. Because it's as much Maria's story and Belle's story as Sydney's. And, there's the other peripheral characters as well, but those three particularly felt almost equally important to me. I don't think I would necessarily, if I hadn't read the blurb first, I wouldn't have come away from it thinking that's Sydney's book. I'd have come away from it thinking that's a book about three women at different stages in their lives, with different issues, and different problems. So,
yeah, absolutely.
But I suppose she's the kind of catalyst for everything that happens, so maybe that's why.
I think it's a really important point, and also this book is a good representation of how not to judge a book by its blurb or its cover or a very short review of it, because books are so much more than what you ever anticipate them to be.
I think that's one of the best things about doing the podcast, actually, is that you pick up books that you might have picked up on the shelf or in the library. Maybe I'd read it, but I probably wouldn't necessarily, because I don't know, maybe it depends on my mood. But the blurb itself wouldn't necessarily have told me how much I would love it. But then having read it, I would say, I really adored it. It was fantastic.
Such lovable characters, weren't they?
Yeah, it was just so, I'm going to overuse the word beautifully again, but it's so beautifully written. Like, the way it writes about changes that you go through in your life, like about loss and how that affects you as a person. And
the grief, and also the longing, and then the looking back that Maria does for her life, which we don't quite understand at first. And then we come to realise what happened to her first love.
Yeah.
And how sad that was.
And just that ability to sort of put, to deal with or address the issues in your past and kind of step into yourself and the person that you really are or really want to be, and that kind of stage of life. And all of them are doing that, but at a different stage, so all of them are taking that step into being their maybe more true to themselves, or being their sort of themselves in their truest sense. I think I gave that 5 stars.
I think I gave it 5 stars on Goodreads. Fabulous book, loved it.
Yeah. Gone for it with the
bits. So the is there a blurb for the warehouse?
Yeah, it's on here.
Oh, okay. Do you want to read it? Is it in front of you?
I can do, yes. So, this is The Warehouse by Rob Hart, and it says, Paxton never thought he'd be working security for the company that ruined his life, much less that he'd be moving into one of their sprawling live-work facilities. But compared to what's left outside, perhaps Cloud isn't so bad. Better still, through his work, he meets Zinnia, who fills him with hope for their shared future. Except that Zinnia is not what she seems, and Paxton, with his all-access security credentials, might just be her meal ticket. As Paxton and Zinnia's agendas place them on a collision course, they're about to learn just how far the Cloud will go to make the world a better place. The warehouse is a brilliantly devised and fantastic world. Hang on. Doesn't make sense. And so that's not part of the blurb anyway. That's, no. that's additional press release stuff. So we'll just pretend I didn't read that.
I really hope the cover of the book is the one we've got. It's quite awesome front cover, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's like a little barcode with a person pushing on it.
Yeah.
And it's just, oh, this book was incredible. I was excited to read it. Like, I thought it was going to be good.
Mm.
Just reading the blurb and reading, like, it comes a lot, you know, all the stuff it came with, and it looked really, really interesting. But it is one of those books that, firstly, I just couldn't put it down.
Mm.
And I just kept thinking about it when I'd finished. It's just so thought-provoking. So many things it made me think about. The characters I kept thinking about, like, their choices, how it happened. But also, because it's this sort of dystopian near future, so it's not actually, I don't know if it says at any point an actual date, but it's intentionally not detailed, not set a long time in the future.
No.
So it's maybe 20, 30, 40 years away from here, where we are now. And it's saying sort of, I guess it's a kind of Amazon-alike.
Do you know what? It's so strange because
I think
Amazon is exactly what was going through my mind the entire time.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think actually this book, I feel like at some point of it, it did make a reference to a previous like online retail giant before the cloud kind of really took off. And I think that's was a sort of subtle reference to be clear that it wasn't talking about Amazon. It was talking about what might come after. Maybe just because it's easier to avoid issues that way. But it definitely felt like that kind of online sort of retail place that monopolises the market in that way did feel very similar to Amazon.
And with the use of drones,
yeah,
which are in constant use at the moment, it's really not something that is too far away into the future.
I mean, it really obviously took the present right now, or when it was written, and then sort of imagined how it could go not too far in the future, because I suppose it's saying drones have moved from being what they are now, which is a sort of reasonably early level technology, to being the company that found a way to deliver stuff with drones.
And so what the cloud are doing is they're wiping out small businesses by essentially doing the job in a much more cost effective and efficient way with the use of the drones.
So there's also things like, it refers to, it never explains what happens, but it refers to the Black Friday massacres. And I think there's it kind of refers to there being a lot of gun violence. So this is set in America, to be clear. So there's sort of a Black Friday situation where there were firearms on sale as part of that thing, right near the front door, and basically there's this huge... So there's that huge event where kind of a mixture of consumerism and gun control laws cause huge issues, and then also there's the kind of ongoing climate change, so that the outside world is very hostile. Like, it referred to as being very, very hot all the time, so I'm guessing that's just global warming. You know, if it hasn't been stopped or no one takes any action, where that might lead.
And so the best place you need to be is working for the cloud.
Yeah,
living in the cloud.
Yeah, and it's a bit like, it all starts to control your whole life. I mean, it's a bit 1984, isn't it, in that sense? Always watching. And it was interesting because, so it's written about from Paxton's point of view and from Zinnia's point of view, but also from the point of view of the guy who created the cloud, the company.
I can't remember his name. Gibson.
Gibson Wells.
Mm.
Which I don't
Orson Welles.
As soon as I read his name, I was like, is that an Orson Welles reference, or is that purely coincidental? Because it felt really like pointed to me, but maybe it's not. Mm. And what I found really interesting about that is that he's sort of explaining himself, and he sounds so reasonable.
Yeah.
And when you're
reading
his parts of it, his blog, so he's...
It's written as a blog, isn't it?
Yeah, it's written as a blog. He's dying of cancer. That's clear from really early
reaching out to his
many fans, I guess. And he's saying, this is my story and this is why I've done what I've done. And when you're reading it, it's so...
Yeah.
It's so easy to understand him. Like, oh, wow, he's a good guy. Yeah. This guy's a good guy. He just wants
he's
the best
for
people.
He's come from nothing. It's almost like that Goodfellas scene when the lad starts his career in the mafia.
Yeah.
Running the errands for all the other people in town, and then it leads to, you know, basically a life of crime, which is kind of how I saw him as a young lad, just doing all these errands for people in the village, and it all sort of leading and getting people
so
on board
sort of
and taking on his own apprentices.
Yeah, and he's just doing all this, you know, he's a self-made man. He's done lots of good things for the environment. Like, he's been very He's been very green in all his organisations, and so you can sort of see when he talks about his company being a family, everything's so reasonable, even where it gets to the point where he's describing things that are clearly appalling. You know, the workers' rights are just frankly completely non-existent, and you know, you can't basically.
And I don't think they
bathroom breaks. And
I don't think they even get a day off, do they?
No, they get no days off. And if you get stuck, so you're. You're rated
on
a star
toilet
system.
Breaks.
Yeah, two toilet breaks in a day, and often you're
break.
Too far away from where the toilet is to actually
exactly.
use that.
It takes you like 15 minutes to walk to a toilet or something, and you get a 20-minute break.
And the thing is, some of this isn't even fictional. Like, some of this is literally the working conditions of some companies.
What was it, something about a chicken farm or something where the employers had to wear diapers?
Yeah.
Because
so there's an. I don't know if it's going to be in the published book. I don't know how much of it's in there, but there's a sort of letter from the author.
Yeah, his reason for writing the book.
Yeah, and it talks about this woman called Maria Fernandez, who in 2014 died in her car where she was sleeping, because she was working at three different Dunkin' Donuts locations, and the only way she could sleep was to move from one to the other, and that's because this was the only way that she could earn enough money. Mm. And basically he's sort of saying that story.
And it still wasn't enough.
Yeah, it still wasn't enough anyway. And that story really triggered him wanting to write something like this, which is, you know, it literally is the world that we're in a way that it could go. It's so, and what's most so frightening about it is it's so plausible. It just could so easily be true.
And on that note, I'll just mention the part that he refers to in there, which is about a story called I Googled it.
Oh, yeah.
And then I ordered it.
It's the Ursula K.
Have you ever read it before? I just read it this morning.
I haven't. I've read books by her, but I haven't read that. It's a short story, isn't
it? So it's the story called The Ones Who Walk Away from
Amelas. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's about this wonderful, beautiful town, and then amongst it, living
in this
dark basement.
So, yeah, this is a short story by Ursula K. Le Guin, who's a really...
I know, I've never heard of her.
Have you really not?
Well, I Googled her and then I looked her up and I saw her. And
so she's a really prolific science fiction fantasy writer, and she's written a lot of science fiction and fantasy works, but they're usually very, they've got a lot of meaning to them.
Mm.
So they're not just, you know, you can get some sci-fi fantasy, which is pretty throwaway, but it's not like that at all.
But that was the perfect reference for this book.
Yeah.
It
made me think I want to go and read that short story, actually, because I've read books of hers before and they're incredible. I would always recommend her as an author.
So how basically everybody's just walking around in this zone, understanding there's this sort of unwritten rule, isn't there, this unwritten kind of notion that this is what's going on and we're only here, we can all have this lovely nice life, but all these people have to suffer as a result of that. And that's what that short story talks
about.
So that
this short
child
story is sort of really in the short story, there's one child who has to suffer for everyone else to have a nice life, and it's that concept of, well, if one person suffering is worth everyone else not having to suffer, or is it basically? But the other point of it, I think, in terms of this book, is that the people who can't stand that concept, who can't live with themselves knowing that someone's suffering for them to be happy, still don't change the system or break the system. They
just
walk
away.
And what the argument in this book is, I suppose, is that you can't just walk away. It's not good enough to just quietly disagree or quietly not participate. You have to actively protest or actively create dissent or action. And it's an interesting challenge. It really made me think about how, you know, the price of convenience, basically.
Mm.
You know, we've all done it. You need something. You order on Amazon, it's there the next day.
Yeah.
It's so easy. And you do it because it's so easy, and you don't always, you know, well, I don't, I think maybe some people do, think about the people who are working for that company, the conditions that
clothes,
they work in, their lives.
Meat, everything that we get that's cheap and easy and convenient. And
yeah, I mean, clothes is a really good example, isn't it? Because there's obviously these huge issues around, you know, workers' rights and making clothes, and also the sort of disposable nature of fashion these days. So, and that's why this book's amazing. It just raises all these many, many social issues. But it's challenging for a book to be this, I'm not sure it's political, but have this much of an agenda, but also be so engaging and readable and gripping.
Yeah.
Like, the story itself would be gripping, even if it wasn't, you know, hugely relevant sort of
and the characters
for our days.
Are really great, and I love Zinnia?
Well, that's Zinnia. How I'm saying it.
Yeah, that's exactly how I say it.
It's going to be like one of those things where you realise that later you've been reading it in your head and saying the name in your head totally wrong.
Yeah. No, I loved her. She was pretty awesome, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was fab. I loved her. Brilliant character. Well, both of them were, actually, because they were coming from very different places, but they were both quite, relatable and enjoyable.
And the one of their sort of taglines was, "The market dictates."
I've got here. Yeah, which Gibson. Is basically... Yeah, do what people want. They sell what they want. They'll buy it.
Sorry, we wiped your company out. That's just the market.
That's what the market dictated. And it's actually, it's a cop-out, isn't it, really? Because it allows you to behave in ways that's totally unethical.
I've written here, they aren't a family. They're a money-grabbing, soul-sucking corporation. I must have been quite riled after I read a few lines to write that.
It's true, though, isn't it? Because quite a lot, I suppose it's probably true of quite a lot of big businesses, is that kind of... They say, "Oh, we're a family," or it's
we're all under the same umbrella. Fuck off, no, you're not.
But actually, it's not true, though, is it? Because at the bottom line, in a capitalist society, which is all consumerist society, I suppose, it comes down to is making money. Comes down to the shareholders. Comes down to the market dictates. It's actually that's what the bottom line is. The bottom line isn't that your workers are your family. In corporations that size, and it. Just don't think it ever will be.
And Paxton's constantly living in sort of limbo because he's wanting to not be working for the cloud, but at the same time he knows it's his only option, but he's in the back of his head. I think there's quite a few lines actually, but I think there was one where it's where he's on the tram and Gibson is there and then somebody says something to him in his head. Oh, he shakes. That's when he meets Gibson for the first time.
Yeah.
And he said something along the lines of the screaming in his head was as loud as the screaming outside, in the crowd.
crowd.
Which is just a perfect illustration of how torn he is completely throughout the novel.
Yeah, so he has a small business and that his small business went out of business because of the cloud. And so I think that...
They peeled eggs or something?
Yeah, a machine that you could put like a boiled an egg into and put it in the microwave and it would come out with a perfect soft boiled egg every time, which actually is a great invention. Yeah. If someone could invent that, that'd be fantastic. I'd be really here for that.
And then they made Cloud Egg, didn't they?
Yeah, so then Cloud sort of... Well, Cloud one of his main buyers, so he sold through them and they put the price down so low that he couldn't cover his overheads and basically drove him out of business. And then... I think they sort of then basically poached his idea. Poached. Well, it's not an egg pun, but I enjoyed it. There you go. You can all enjoy that. exactly. it's on one level, it's just a gripping, engaging thriller that's really fantastic and enjoyable to read. But on the other hand, it's hugely sort of powerful call to, I'm not sure it's a call to, but sort of, I suppose, a wake-up call.
Just going to outline something here, which we won't actually... say.
Oh yeah, so there are some bits of it which are truly shocking.
Like, we can't say what it is.
Like,
but oh my god, when I read that bit, that's like, have you ever read The Help?
Yes.
So that was kind of on par with Minnie's chocolate pie moment.
Yeah, it's
for me.
Really kind of awful, and it does again though. It's not.
It's the whole scene, the way it's written, the way.
Yeah. It's very visceral, isn't it?
The way like,
Zinnia discovers something that. About the cloud or about what they do, and it's really, really disgusting. All I can tell you, it's really grim. But again, it does make you think because you can. It's not implausible. Even though when you're reading it, you're like, oh, this is awful. This could never.
When
happen.
They described why this was happening, I was like,
that's totally reasonable. Well, it's not reasonable. It's actually disgusting and awful. But it's also, really plausible. You can really see the chain of events, the discussions, the meetings that would lead to that decision being made, and people going, this is okay, we can do this, we can market this.
Yeah.
Like, oh, God. So
that's all we'll say on that.
So, but basically it's a fantastic book, I would say. It's one of those books, actually, we say lots of books are good and lots of books are, but I'm going to annoy people to read this one.
Yeah, me too.
I'm going to go around... physically making people read it if I can.
It's completely ingrained in my head. The Warehouse, Rob Hart. I completely remember his name
and
the title. I'm not gonna forget that for a long time.
To be honest with you, for a few days afterwards, I had to keep reminding myself that it wasn't real. And that's how sort of, I'd be watching, I'd be reading news stories and I'd think in my head that I had read a news story that was actually in the book because it's so believable that I sort of slipped between realities a little bit in my head, maybe. I don't know. So yeah, this is the kind of one where I'm going to go around saying to everybody, you must read this.
Yeah, this is the book of 2019 that you have to read.
So also it says it's been the film, I'm just looking at the PR
stuff. There's going to be some film rights.
Yeah, the film rights have been sold. So Ron Howard is set to direct it, apparently.
Oh.
That's what it says on here. I don't know how everyone feels about that. I don't know enough about films to know if that's good or bad news.
Also, I didn't know about Paku Man, did you? Paku Man. Pac-Man.
That came from really enjoyed that.
Paku Man, which was Japanese or something for... I can't remember what it was. There was a...
Yeah, it did say. It said the origin of the game Pac-Man.
Mm.
And the origin of the name, and I've forgotten it now, but it was interesting.
Yeah, something about that, wasn't it?
Yeah, you have to read the book to find that out, guys. Yeah. That's a teaser for you. And you should all read the book anyway.
So. And also, I just want to say about the other characters, Dobbs and Dakota...
I loved.
And how great they were as characters. Because yeah. Again, in that sort of whole Gibson sense, you could almost kind of like them.
This is the thing, again, it's that thing where you feel good people doing things that are not good for good reasons, or reasons that at least they believe to be good. I suppose it's the way that you can trick yourself into believing that what you're doing is justifiable.
And Paxton has always needed that reassurance and that validation, didn't he? So whenever he got called son or something from...
Had some daddy issues.
Was it Dobbs or Dakota? It was Dobbs, the male, wasn't it? Dakota was the female. That would completely just give him that extra boost to, I can do this, I want to stay here, this is for me.
So when he got approval from someone who was in a position of power, or power necessarily, but... someone, his boss, basically, that approval made him, he wanted it, he was really clinging to it, desperate for it, basically, even though at the same time he was hating it and didn't want to be there. Once he was there, he couldn't stop wanting approval, which is such a very human trait, isn't it? You want to please people. Yeah. Most people do anyway.
I was thrilled to receive an advanced copy of Heidi Perks' new novel, Come Back For Me, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Come Back For Me is published in hardback on the 11th of July, and I'm very lucky to have Heidi here with me now. Thanks, Heidi, for joining me on Sniffing the Pages. I'm so very close to your publication date, which is tomorrow, isn't it?
It is, yep. It's out tomorrow in hardback.
So how are you feeling with the lead up to publication?
I'm actually really excited about it now. It's been out in ebook since the 1st of June, so it's been out there for about 6 weeks, and it's had a really great response. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to the hardback coming out and seeing it on the shelves tomorrow.
And Come Back For Me is your third novel, is that right?
Yes, okay. That's right. Yeah.
So how did you become a writer of psychological thrillers, and what drew you into that particular genre?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I think I just kind of fell into it, in that psychological thrillers is by far my go-to genre when I'm reading. I absolutely love them and I can't get enough of them. So for me, it was just I couldn't really imagine writing anything else, because that is what I love and that is what I know. And there's nothing really else that I can imagine that I would do. I mean, one day I think I might try and write a young adult or something like that, but for me, psychological thrillers for now is definitely the place that I want to be when I'm writing.
And do you think if you write a young adult, you might stick with the same genre? Because there's quite a bit of a fashion now for some young adult psychological thrillers.
Yeah, there are. And I've read a few of them myself. And my children aren't at that age yet. But I think in a few years' time, when they are of that age, that they'll be reading it, and I'll probably have a better feel of what's out there. Then, yeah, I think that's definitely what I'd be writing then as well.
I got a feel for psychological thrillers reading them and writing them when I was younger, because do you ever remember that book called I Know What You Did Last Summer? And then they made it into a film as well.
No, I remember the film.
Somebody got run over or something, and then all these people were sort of sending all these messages, like a high school type scenario.
That's right. Yeah, that
was such a good book at that time for sort of young adults. Yeah. But I guess before young adults had that particular genre set for them. So what inspires you to write? Is it something that you have to do, or do you just want to share your stories? Is it just something that's burning within you every day?
I think initially it was something that I'd always wanted to try. So I didn't know whether I could or not. I'd always loved writing as a child. I always used to write a lot of poems and short stories. But in my head, I always, if anyone ever asked me what was the one thing I would like to do, it was always, one day I'm going to write a book. So I think I always knew that I was going to try it. But now that I am writing, it's less about sharing my stories. For me, it is just, I cannot imagine doing anything else, because it becomes a little all-absorbing to a degree. And even when I went through a period of having quite a few rejections and being knocked back and wondering whether or not I wanted to carry on doing it, I remember just sitting there and thinking, do you know what, there's just nothing else that I want to do now. I love writing so much that I'm really doing what is my passion, I'm doing what is my dream. So I do feel incredibly lucky to be doing that as well.
So if it's not too painful to look back and remember on those rejections, because I know how awful that is,
can you remember
what that time was like, and do you have a rough number, a rough figure? Can you, because I know JK Rowling likes to talk about how many rejections she had before Harry Potter became a bestseller. So can you remember those days clearly?
Oh, totally. Yeah, no, it completely. I mean, there's rejections at each different stage. So, I mean, when I first tried to get an agent, there were so many, you don't really get rejections necessarily, but you just don't hear anything back. So that was quite tough in the first kind of year or so of trying to actually find an agent. But then I did find an agent. And when my first book, Beneath the Surface, was sent out on submission to publishers, it was sent to, I reckon, 24, 25 publishers. And I had a rejection from every single one of them. And that was the most demoralizing point of, I reckon, the whole journey that I've had so far, because you think you've come so far, you've written a book, you've had an agent pick it up who tells you that they love it, who has put it out to the world of editors, and none of them want it. And at that point, I remember saying, well, what do I do now? And she said, well, I think you've just got to write another book. And you sit there and think, oh, I can't do that. I can't go through all of that again. You get so far in a journey and then it doesn't go anywhere. So that was definitely the hardest time for me. And that was the point where I really had to think, do I want to keep going with this? And I decided I did. And I decided at that point that I was going to self-publish Beneath the Surface, which is what I did.
Oh, you did? Fantastic.
Yes, I did. So yes, and my first book I actually self-published. That was 3.5 years ago. So the second book that I wrote, Now You See Her, that was traditionally published. I basically decided I wanted to go through the whole process again of finding a new agent, of finding a publisher. And thankfully that time I was slightly more successful.
Yeah. So you found yourself a new agent, and Now You See Her was a Richard and Judy book club pick. So how did that come about and how did you feel about that whole process?
Well, that was just incredibly exciting, because Richard and Judy was just my dream to have one of my books picked for them, because I've always loved Richard and Judy selections. I always check out what the latest ones are, and I always buy them and read them for myself. So to actually have been picked was amazing. But I remember my editor calling me up last November and telling me the news, but then in the same sentence saying, but you cannot tell a soul, you're not allowed to tell anybody. For the next 4 months, I think it was. So it was just a really big secret that I had to keep, which was very hard, because it was very exciting. But no, to get Richard and Judy is fantastic, because it makes the book very high profile.
Yeah. So what did Richard have to say about it? Can you remember? Because he always has great things doesn't he?
They do. They totally do. They both did. And yeah, just very enthusiastic about it and really loved it. And you know, you just really do get a sense of how much they love a book, and because of the way they talk to you about it and the questions that they ask, it you can see it comes from the heart as well. So no, it was one of my favorite days of my writing journey so far was meeting them.
So you met them, did you say?
Fantastic.
Yes,
I went to London to meet them.
So just talking about your writing then, so what's your favorite time of day to write? I know obviously you have children, so it's quite difficult to squeeze things in, isn't it? But do you have a favorite time of day or place to write?
Not really a favorite time of day, but I basically do all my writing when the children are at school. So I have 6 hours roughly in between drop off and pick up to write, and I will make sure I write for four of them. That's my target, is that I write for four a day. And some weeks I'll write a lot more and some weeks I'll write a lot less. So I just basically try and get as much done when they're not around. And I also try and structure all my deadlines with my editors as well around the term time, so that I can be with children when they're on holidays as well. Because firstly, primarily to be with them, but also because it is really difficult to write when I find it very difficult to write when there's nothing but silence in the house. So as soon as there's children, you can't switch off and you can't get into the place that you need to be in.
No. So this is a book podcast, Sniffing the Pages, and we just absolutely devour books 24/7 if we can do. So what did you enjoy reading as a child, and how do you think that shaped your writing?
I remember my first books were Enid Blyton. I just was so absorbed and fell in love with all of the Famous Five and the Secret Seven and all the mountain and castle and island of adventures. And I can just remember being off school one day and sitting on the sofa and just reading a whole book in a day. And
those were the days.
Just magic. Oh yeah, completely. It was just magical to like fall into a story. And so it was predominantly her. My very, very favourite book was a book that not many people have heard of, which was the last of the really great Wang Doodles, which was a book that I've since learned was written by Julie Andrews, but she didn't have her right name on it. Yeah, so, and I've just read that to my 9-year-old daughter, who absolutely loves it. So, yeah, no, I've always loved reading. And the last of the really great Wang Doodles.
The last of the really great one.
It's all about three children, I think it is, of by memory, who have to use their imagination to travel to this land where they're looking for the Wang Doodle. But it's a really, really good story, and it just stuck with me forever. And I remember thinking, am I gonna still love it when I read it to my daughter? But I did, and she absolutely loved it.
Well, so. I've got a 9-year-old, so nine or ten.
Look it out. It is, yeah, one out for her. and I just love reading, and I still absolutely love reading now.
How often can you get to read then between kids and
writing? I read
every
day.
And will you read whilst you're writing a book? Because quite often authors
I do, but I have to admit it is becoming harder, especially when you are reading in the genre that you're writing. I can't imagine not. I love every night when I go to bed, I will read for half an hour before I fall asleep, and so I'll never not do that. And I have tried reading a few books that are completely in a different genre, but I do tend to come back to the same ones again. But no, it is harder when you are writing. It is harder. And there was a book recently that I tried to read again for a second time, and I just couldn't, because I just thought, it's so much better than mine. It's funny, isn't it? Not that necessarily, but I think you're in danger of thinking, I just don't want to copy, or I don't want to be too swayed by it to start changing my own writing style. So
At the point of where I am at the moment in publication, I've just finished reading a book by Holly Bourne called How Do You Like Me Now? And it's possibly one of the best books I've read this year. And
that's young adult, isn't it?
Half thinking, I'm destroyed because this is just amazing writing, and half, you know, I didn't want it to end, and I was having a massive book hangover. But it's hard, isn't it?
It's difficult to get that balance, absolutely.
So, well, that's just brought me on to my next question, which was, which adult book do you love so much that you wish you'd written it yourself? Will you give us the title?
Well, it is this one. It's the one that I can't... It's Big Little Lies by Leanne Moriarty.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
I absolutely love, and which someone once described to me was a masterclass in plotting, which I completely 100% agree with, because it is just superbly plotted. Yeah. And has that right balance between thriller and comedy. Yeah. And just, I just love it. And the book I'm writing at the moment is different, very different to that in terms of style. And that's why I had to put it down, because I thought, I'm beginning to think I need to write more like that. And then I thought, no, I don't. I've got to stick with what I'm doing. But yeah, no, absolutely. That is the book. 100% I wished I'd read.
I totally agree. I'm watching the series at the moment, but I still always remember finishing that book a couple of years ago. I was on a girls' reading retreat thing, and and that was the book I was reading. And I just remember putting it down and thinking, wow, you know, that was fantastic. So I'm totally with you on that one.
Totally with me. Good.
And so... in amongst all your writing and your reading and your kids, do you get time to communicate with fans, and do you use social media, or is it just a big distraction? And
No, it is a massive distraction, isn't it? But I think we're all completely distracted by it, and I can't, and it's really difficult not to be. And maybe I just need to turn off the Wi-Fi and go and sit somewhere where I can't have access to it. But I guess I love to read. I read everything that everybody's written. I read every review, and I read every comment that I have. And it's predominantly, I'd say, on Twitter and Facebook. The two areas that I guess I communicate with fans the most, but or readers really the most. But I many days wish social media wasn't there so that I didn't have that distraction.
It's got a lovely writing community feel, so there's a lot of support there, isn't there, for writers?
Massive, really massive support, and so far I've had really great support as well, which is fantastic. No, totally.
So you are, did you say you're in the process of writing your fourth novel?
I am,
The same genre, psychological thriller still?
I am, yep, totally. And this one's going to be out next July, I assume, next 2020. So yeah, I'm in the process of writing that one at the moment, and really enjoying it. And it's just great to, you know, get to know some new characters and everything. So yeah, no, I'm enjoying this one.
Brilliant. And Come Back For Me is published in hardback tomorrow, July 11th.
It is.
And what are your plans for the day? Do you have any special fancy plans?
I'm actually going to have a book launch party tomorrow night. Lovely. So yeah, for friends and family. And I didn't do anything for Now You See Her when that came out last year, and I felt the day that sort of came and went, and I hadn't thought of doing anything, and it was a bit of a that's a shame, I should have done something. So I'm definitely looking forward to tomorrow night, really looking forward to it, just as a bit of a celebration.
Oh, fantastic. Well, best of luck with the book.
Thank you very much
for coming and chatting to us on Sniffing the Pages today.
Thank you, Nina. Thank you for having me.
So, Katie, what you been reading?
So, I've read a couple of books. So
one table's really squeaky.
Yeah, the table is knocking it back and forth. So this is, it's called Love Unscripted. It's by Owen Nichols, and it's out in August, I think.
Yeah, all these books are out in August.
Yes, all these books are out of August. We should probably have said that already. It says it's a love story. It's basically a rom-com. It feels very rom-com when you read it. It feels
more of the rom, less the com.
Yeah, maybe. I think rom-com is used very much as a descriptor for just romance, and not all romantic comedies are actually that funny. And maybe there are humorous moments in it, for certain. And interestingly, I thought about it when I was reading it, that it probably would work better as a film than a book. I wouldn't be surprised if it got made into a film. And I would think it would probably make a slightly better film than a book, maybe. I don't know. I just found that the way it played out felt quite cinematic. From that perspective. So basically, it's about Nick and Ellie, and their sort of their relationship and the way that it happens and then falls apart and how it goes on. And it was a nice book. It reminded me of a book I read years ago, and I've forgotten the name of the author. So it's going to be uses Mike Gale.
Probably.
Oh, that got back into my head. So that kind of book, Mike Gale, David Nichols, those sorts of stories. And it was good. I enjoyed it.
What else you been reading?
And the other one I was going to talk about is by someone called Naomi Novik, and it's called Uprooted.
Ooh,
and it's sort of interestingly, when I was told about it, I was told it was a retelling of Beauty and the Beast, or a sort of skew on Beauty and the Beast. But actually, it didn't really feel quite like that to me. I'm not quite sure why. I don't know if someone told me that because that's how it was written, or if someone told me that because that's how they interpreted it, if that makes sense. But basically, there's this, it's a fantasy, or it's a fairy tale story, and they live in a valley, and every 10 years a wizard called the dragon comes and takes one girl from the village and keeps her for 10 years, and at the end of 10 years she's allowed to go on her way. She never comes back to her home village. She always just goes off. And so the protagonist in the book obviously is chosen by the dragon, but it turns out that she's got magic. And the whole book just really escalates. It's just really, if you like fairy tales or that kind of, it's basically grown-up fairy tales, probably the best way to describe it. And it's really about maybe people's motivations or the way that, yeah, the reasons you choose to do things, and maybe a little bit, not at all similar to The Warehouse actually, but in only in as far as people think that when they think they're doing the right thing, what people might do. Mm. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's interesting, it was recommended to me when I went to that book spa.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't one of the books that...
You didn't pick up?
No, well, it wasn't even that, actually. It was... We were chatting about it before. It wasn't one of the books that was brought to me for me to take home. I think she just sort of said it to me, like, you will definitely love this one. Whereas I get the impression with them that the idea of the reading spa books they recommend to you is to give you something you might not otherwise have picked up.
Mm.
Whereas yeah. that...
You it's absolutely that, would have done.
Yeah, that book is very me. I could easily have come across it and picked it up of my own accord, whereas the nice thing about the reading spa is it totally gave me access to books that I would probably never have picked up normally. Mm. So this sort of came up in our chats at the beginning and was easily something I would definitely have
What was it called?
Uprooted.
By?
Naomi Novik. Mm. And she's written others as well. So this is the other thing that's nice about this I really quite liked, is that lots of fantasy books or... Yeah, books in that genre are trilogies or series, and some of them are long series. Like, we've talked about this last time, didn't we? Like, I read one recently that was 7 books long, and the last book was like 900 pages, so it's epic.
Oh my gosh, really?
And even the first ones are quite short, but from the middle onwards, they're a good 600, 700 pages upwards. So they're not quick to read. Well, there's a fussy reader space, but they're not little light books. And this isn't short particularly, but it's a standalone. So it was nice to read a standalone novel.
Yeah.
And not get to the end of it and have that kind of, oh my God, what happens next? Yeah. I need the next book feeling.
Yeah.
Just have it be a sort of standalone fairy story.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely, if you like, sort of mystical fairy tales or that kind of fantasy genre, I really enjoyed that. I think, I'm not certain, but I think it comes under the young adult fiction fantasy banner. But I always think there's a bit of a blurry line about young adult fantasy and adult fantasy, which when you say adult fantasy sounds dodgy, but that's not what I mean. You know what I mean? Full on fantasy science fiction and young adult science fiction. Because I've read loads
that's
of
for
books
another
that...
season, chat.
Yeah, that's the X-rated episode. No, I've read loads of books in the young adult section or young adult classification that are in the fantasy genre as well, and I just find it really hard to understand why some are classified young adult and why some are not, because lots of the ones I've read.
Yeah, I guess fantasy is fantasy, isn't it, at the end of the day?
I mean, I think it's maybe a lot to do with the protagonist and the age of the protagonist sometimes.
Mm.
It makes more sense when you... I think this is an issue as well, that people who write or publish in this area would acknowledge exists, that kind of, blurring. And I think often it's because publishers feel that it's more likely to sell in a young adult market, or if it's marketed as a young adult book.
Would you like to write young adult fantasy?
I would like to write fantasy. I don't know if it would be young adult.
Mm.
See, I think probably if I was to write fantasy, in my head, it would be just pure... I'd just write it as a fantasy. I wouldn't write it intentionally to be young adult, but it might end up coming out that way. I don't know if it's because... maybe the age of people in it. Lots of fantasy novels have quite young main characters.
Mm.
But that's a really weird sentence, because if you think about it, Lord of the Rings has got very young protagonists, and that's not a young adult fantasy, not least because the young adult wasn't a genre when that was published. But I think that sort of highlights the difference. I don't know, because I've read fantasy series that are quite adult in tone and topic but are definitely marketed as young adult. I've definitely read some that are quite explicit sexually, that I would not want my 14-year-old reading, to put it that way. And I'm sometimes a bit not quite sure how I'd feel about my young adult child reading that. I'd want you to wait till you're 16 plus, at least. Although that said, I don't know, when I was younger I ended up reading some...
Yeah.
You know.
Judy Blume.
Well, stuff. Yeah, exactly. Think a bit of Ginny Cooper, actually.
Forever.
There's always, I particularly when I was younger, I basically read all my way through the library, local library, and all the way through them.
You were proper Matilda, weren't you?
Yeah, without the magic. So disappointed. But yeah, I ended up reading.
Trotting down to the library with your little
absolutely.
Pull along.
Literally was. You're joking, but when I was at school, I can't remember how old I was, but I got a Saturday job in the library. And the major reason was because when you worked at the library, you could just take more books out and for longer. It was brilliant. And also, all the new books that were coming out I could reserve them before anyone else knew they were available.
I know, she does that. Babs does that at the local library there.
Of course she does. I didn't know that one was coming.
Oh, I'll put my name down for that one.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be like looking up authors that I liked and watching, like putting their books on reserve as soon as they came on the system. And come straight into the library and go straight to my house. I know.
Criminal.
Yeah, exploiting the system. Anyway, that was a bit of a rambling. That's a rambling chat, but...
Great books.
Yeah, they were good. They were good books. I enjoyed them. That's the upshot of that.
So this is our final episode of this season. Katie and I are going to take a little break over the summer holidays to do mummy things and run around forests and beaches and play centres with our kids.
And probably not have nearly enough time to read, frankly.
And Katie's got a dog.
I've got a puppy to train.
Puppy, so there'll be lots of that.
You choose my books, by the way.
I know. That happened. Willow did that. I can't remember what book it was she did. She chewed the entire thing. I had to go out and buy it again.
Oh, no. Oh, well, it hasn't been quite that bad, but we've definitely chewed a corner of a book, and it's my mum lent me as well, so I feel awful. Yeah, she's had a real gnaw at it. So.
Oh.
Not a book-loving puppy. Or maybe she is a book-loving puppy, actually, but not in quite the right way.
No. So we're having a little break, and then we're back in sort of September time-ish, with season two for some more great reads. We've got a few in the pipeline already, but in the meantime we just wanted to have a little chat about some of the books that have inspired us and entertained us and made us cry hysterically and
the favourites, that would be the way of putting
it. The five stars.
Yeah, so I think I didn't list everyone I'd given five stars to, although most of them. Do you want to start?
Well, absolutely 100%. Oh, actually, I'm going to say this first before, because I promised Lisa Heathfield, who is a fantastic writer of young adult novels, that I would mention her recent novel, which was published last month. It's a young adult novel. She is a writer of young adult novels, and her most recent book is called I Am Not a Number.
Oh, we've heard of that.
It's a brilliant, brilliant book. And
we've heard of it because you've read it.
Yeah, I was posted a proof of it, and... it was a very proofy proof, so it was an A4 sort of proof.
Yeah, I remember
type proof. The proofiest of proofs.
I'm going to be telling you about this now, but it sounded amazing.
Yeah, it was so fantastic. I could not literally put it down, and my heart was pounding the entire way through.
I have to read that.
And it's a brilliant book. So she's written a couple of books. I've read Paper Butterflies is another one of hers. And yeah, she writes some pretty sort of hardcore topics. But yeah. Kind of readable that isn't quite as distressing as you think it will be, but
I will keep my eyes out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking. It's really hard to narrow this down.
Yeah.
So we said five, roughly.
Yeah.
And I've ended
I've got five.
Well, I've ended up with six because I had five, and then I added the warehouse.
Ooh.
So that makes it six. So now I'm just cheating. Like I didn't take one of them off.
Yeah.
To add it.
Yeah.
So it was difficult.
Well, that's fine. We can say the warehouse because. We've just talked about it, but
yeah, exactly. So we don't have to talk about that anymore. So I think we probably have quite a similar list.
Yeah, but I'm thinking Stella Fortuna.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I've recommended that so many times to people.
Yeah, I've recommended that
as an epic novel.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Stella Fortuna was a beautiful book. And Tiger, Polly Clark, which I think you've also got.
Yeah.
Which is another incredible novel that you I think we said at the time, one of those ones that you wish you'd written.
Yeah.
I just wish I saw the world in that way.
So many little paragraphs and little sentences that she wrote that were just unbelievably well written.
Yeah.
Daisy Jones and the Six, I've got.
So that's not on my list, but although it is a fantastic book, I agree.
That's another one that I recommend many, many times to people.
But I have recommended that to people, and I've seen a lot of people saying that they loved it.
Yeah.
There's been a huge amount of positive sort of response to that, so... which is well deserved.
So what else have you got then?
So Louie and Louise by Julie Cohen, which I think we were just saying has been renamed slightly, and I can't remember what the new title is, but it's still got Louie and Louise in the title. So, and that was, yeah, I really loved that book actually. It was really fantastic.
If Only I Could Tell You by Hannah Beckerman.
Oh, that was an amazing book. Again, not on my list, but only just not on my list, if that makes sense.
I think that book will forever have our tears embedded into the pages.
That broke me a little bit. So Changeling. Matt Wesenowski, which is incredible.
Oh, you snuck that one in there.
Yeah.
Cheeky. I did forget about it.
That's the problem. We've read so many good books. I know. That's the issue. That's the thing. When you start looking back, you're like, oh no, I want to say about that one.
Yeah, because that's a good...
I recommended that to several people. And several people, I've, so I recommended it to my husband and my dad, who both read it now. And both of them also agreed it was fantastic and really loved it. So
I put 7 Days of Us, which is kind of a bit of nostalgia because that takes us right back to December.
Yeah.
to our first podcast.
That is a good book.
And it was when Katie and I didn't actually really know each other at all.
We just hung out.
I just said, come round and talk about books. Yeah. And we just cracked on, and that was the first book we talked about, wasn't it?
It was just a good opportunity to talk about books, not in between yelling at our children at playgrounds.
Yeah.
conversations just kept getting interrupted.
We'll soon be at reading Christmas books again, and I've got already a couple on my shelf looking at me, awesome. Winking at me.
I love
ready
Christmas
for Christmas.
Because I love Christmas. and so the last one I had was The Migration, Helen Marshall.
Which I liked but made me feel
eerie. Definitely. That was one that actually I don't think I have actually given that to my dad yet, but I'm going to.
It's definitely not
my
one
dad gets
I'll forget.
All his books by getting them off me.
It's definitely one I won't ever forget.
Yeah, the more I thought about it afterwards, the more I liked it. I think that's how I felt about that one.
Yeah.
I read it quite quickly.
It's almost quite fantasy / dystopian.
Yeah, it just was such an interesting, clever book. I really enjoyed it, and it was, beautifully done. So I was up there on my list.
Yeah.
So yeah, those are our top five. But there were so many more that were good.
Yeah, so many more. Like The Dinner List was great.
Yeah, The Dinner List was on my list. What was the one that I didn't... I was umming and ahhing about some. I'll see if I can remember which one was the one I was trying to arm and ah about. What was it? Sorry, this is a really long pause now while I look back through my Goodreads history. trying to remember what I've read this year.
I'm just going to whistle some lift music.
Vox we talked about, which was really good. That's not what I was thinking about there.
Yeah, I mean, that's another epic, awesome book that's along the sort of lines of The Warehouse.
The Binding, there you go. Right back to the beginning as
the
well.
The Binding.
That was from January. Sorry, I had to do some scrolling to get to that one, which I also really loved.
That was just a beautiful looking book, wasn't it?
Oh, it's gorgeous, yeah. Interestingly, is the best book you've read in 2019 one of the podcast books? Or
absolutely.
Else? Is it? Which one is it?
you
said absolutely. Now I'm going to put you on the spot.
I would... Oh, it's a bit of a toss-up, really, between Stella Fortuna and If Only I Could Tell You.
Yeah, it's tricky.
I'd probably say Stella Fortuna.
Controversially, I think the best book I've read this year isn't actually one of the podcast books.
Get out!
I know, I'm so sorry.
Get out of this...
It's close. It's close.
Have you discussed it on the podcast?
Yes, I mentioned it as one of my additional reads. And it's called The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin. And it was
That's acceptable. Then.
Incredible. Incredible book. I'm just mentioning it again because more people should read it.
Yeah.
But actually, to be fair, if I was gonna give my top 10 books of 2019, I think probably a good... Apart from that trilogy... I think the rest of them would probably be podcast books, which goes to show the quality of books that we've been able to read and lucky enough to read and discuss.
It's been pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's been amazing. I've had so few that I've not liked.
And there's some good ones that are coming in already for autumn.
Can't wait.
Oh, yeah.
Can't wait. So we're off to, enjoy our summer holidays.
Get ourselves an hour suntan.
yeah.
We'll try. In amongst all the other activities.
There are days when holidays were just... I remember when I used to go on holiday and take a book for every day because I'd just be able to lie by the pool and read a book a day.
Yeah.
And still go out and do things.
Yeah.
There'd be enough additional time to read a whole book nearly every day. And now that is not what my holidays are like. We're going camping this year. I don't think I'm going to get to pick up a book.
Nope.
With my head torched in the tent while the children have gone to bed at whatever god-awful time the children eventually go to sleep when they're camping.
Yeah.
just not the same.
No, they're not the same, no. It's a different life.
Enjoyable in different ways, but there's less reading involved in it, let's put it that way.
There's a lot more Julia Donaldson involved in this life.
Yeah. It's nice, actually. So my daughter's just turned 5. We're just starting to get to the age where I'm reading like chapter books with her at bedtime. And really enjoyable.
Willow. Dog snoring.
It's nice to read something. No, I mean, Julia Donaldson is amazing, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But I've read them all so many times now that I think I could probably recite them.
Yeah.
So it's nice to get a bit of variety.
Mm.
So that's been quite fun. So maybe we'll talk about that a little bit in September as well. Some children's
we should do some more children's books, because I think we did do a children's book podcast on World Book Day.
Yeah, and it was really...
That was really, really well received, so...
I'm not sure quite how much insightful comment my five-year-old will bring to the situation.
It would be
fun. I can report her comments if you like.
It would be fun to have the kids chatting about books. That would make quite an interesting podcast. It would be great to have one sometime.
I'd be very interested to hear Huxley and Teddy's opinions. Huxley's just turned 2 and Teddy's just turned 3. That would be... We could ask what their favourite books are, though, and see what outcome was.
Bop each other over the head with books.
I should tell you that Teddy's favourite book at the moment is an Osborne book. It's it's a sound book, so you could press the sounds, and it's called Noisy Bottoms.
Oh.
And the sounds are exactly as you'd imagine a book called Noisy Bottoms.
Different types of noisy bottoms?
Well, just a variety on a theme, let's put it that way. It's obviously, when you're 3, about the funniest thing that a book can do is make fart noises, isn't it? Like... What more can you look for?
One to review for next season.
Absolutely. 10 out of 10 from Teddy.
And on that note...
We will see you in the autumn.
See you in the autumn, yeah.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.